Mr. O'Keefe, I'm an alcoholic. Member of the Miami Men's Group in Miami, Florida. Bunch of misogynists that rattle around down there and cause trouble. And I have been asked up here to do this. Hillary asked me up here because I've been in AA a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been doing something for a long time. And I have done these things before, so you need not concern yourself. I'll do it all. I usually enter a few disclaimers before I start. I'm not here to teach anybody anything. I'm not here in the capacity as a teacher. I'm not here to explain the big book or the steps. They're all in the English language. They're all easy to understand, no big words or anything. What I bring to this this gathering is experience. I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous since November the 24th, 1965. I had a sponsor, I have a sponsor, and I asked him very early on, first week or two, I asked him because I suspected, I didn't want to make an issue of it, but I suspected a number of the people that I was associating with had not been to college. I wasn't causing an issue, I didn't raise the issue, but nevertheless. And I said, how many times a week do I have to hang out with this bunch? He said, we talked it over, and we think 7 a week ought to do it. I said, my God, that's every day. He said, you're getting bright already. Well, I don't like people pushing me around. So I went to about 9. Now it's 32 years later, I'm going to 8. So I bring to you a lot of experience in AA meetings, and when you go to that many meetings, you pick up a lot of information, and I have a lot of information. I try not to enforce my opinions on you. I'm very opinionated. I have an opinion about everything, but unlike your opinions, my opinions are grounded in experience and revealed truth. Because I walk with Hillary, and Hillary walks with God, and, you know, it's in a direct line. And I'm pals with Jerry, and what Hillary doesn't know, Jerry knows, and between the two of them, I get all my instructions. Now, the way I start these things is I talk about a history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the history that begins in Akron, Ohio. In fact, the history, as I look at it, ends in Akron, Ohio. And I like it. It's a good story. It's a true story. It's a very interesting story. And like all true interesting stories, it has a moral. And I like the way I tell it. Now, I don't know when Alcoholics Anonymous was, the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. When that happened is beyond my knowledge. It seems to me that spiritual movements such as Alcoholics Anonymous, which have been in the world for forever, have their origins, I suppose, somewhere in the mind of God or some other benevolent force that is in charge of such things. But in any event, they began to assemble a cast of characters. I look at this thing almost like it's a play. A cast of characters began to assemble before World War I in a little town in Vermont called Manchester, Vermont. Manchester, Vermont is in the southern portion of Vermont. It's a gorgeous, beautiful resort town. It's at that portion of Vermont, where Vermont, New York, and Massachusetts all come together, down around Bennington. It's just a gorgeous place. It's the foothills of the Green Mountains. It's got its own mountain, the Equinox Mountains are there. It's got these beautiful Victorian homes. It's got a gorgeous hotel with a big porch like the Grand Hotel. And it has a prep school in it, Manchester Prep. And down from East Dorset, Vermont, which is up the road on Route 7, I went to college up there, that's why I know the area. On Route 7, which used to be the main north and south road before the interstate, and down on Route 7, from Route 7, came Bill Wilson, before the war, to attend the prep school, Manchester Prep. He came down with his baseball glove and his violin and his boomerang and began to attend the prep there. And then over from Albany, New York, which is about 30 miles to the west, on on a straight line, there came a young man named Ebbie Thatcher. Ebbie's family prominent in Albany, and they had a summer residence in Manchester, Vermont, right on the main street. Then up from Brooklyn, New York, came a young lady named Lois Burnham with her father, Dr. Burnham, and they vacationed there every summer, the doctor and his daughter. And then up from Manhattan, from New York City, by way of Newport, Rhode Island, came a very wealthy young man named Roland Hazard, whose family had a farm, gentleman's farm, about 25 miles outside of Manchester. And they all began to mix the way young people do, who are high school teenagers. Bill went off to college. He went up to Northfield, Vermont, to a college, Norwich it's called. It's sort of, it's a small school, sort of a semi-military, big ROTC. And the war came, World War I. Bill tells us in his book, and he was a second lieutenant in the Vermont National Guard because he went to Norwich, and the Vermont National Guard was a field artillery unit, and they went overseas with their cannons. And Bill tells us about being in the Westminster Cathedral and reading the stuff on the tombstone about the grenadier who died, you know, and how prophetic it would be later on. Well, Bill went through the war, came out of it fine. He came out of it with a commendation from his battery. He was just doing well. He and Lois got married, and everybody else sort of dispersed the way your college friends and high school friends, and you did. You just, everybody went their own way. And Bill went to New York City, went to work in an insurance company, went to law school, nights, graduated law school. The rest of them just went away. And the first one to get in trouble with alcohol was Roland Hazard, the rich kid. He became a real serious problem. And his family tried everything there was with him. They sent him to every sanitarium there was in this country. They tried everything that money can do, and it was to no avail. So he finally ended up in Switzerland with the great Carl Jung. He stayed with Carl Jung a whole year. Jung really didn't appreciate what he had there, but he discharged Roland after a year. Shook his hand, told him to carry on, and Roland started back, and he got as far as Paris, and someone asked him the wrong question. Someone said to Roland, would you like a drink? The only time I ever said no to that question, I completely misunderstood the question. So Roland had a drink, and you know what that is, and there he is a week later, he's rolling around the gutter, and so he did what you and I would do. He went back to Jung. He said, what's going on? You know, I spent a whole year, and I'm just as bad as ever. And Jung, greatest psychiatrist at the time, colleague of Sigmund Freud and all the rest, pronounced a death sentence on Roland Jung, Roland Hazard. See, Jung never really appreciated the fact that he was an alcoholic. He thought he was something else. Weird, but something else. He said, now I know you're an alcoholic now. He said, let me tell you the bad news. The bad news is this. I have never seen an alcoholic of your type recover. How's that? You will go insane and you will die. Roland said, I would say, is there no possible way? Oh, Jung said, yes, once in a while, here and there, now and again, very rare, it's a phenomenon. People like you have a religious transference, and they stop drinking. But otherwise, no hope for you. It's nice to have money, because Roland went out to buy himself a religious experience, which is possible if you have enough money. And he found the Oxford Group. Now, the Oxford Group were a bunch of Christians who were loosely affiliated with the Episcopal Church. And they were started by a very charismatic gentleman from Pennsylvania named Buckman, who had been a teacher at various schools and was associated with the YMCA and a church in New York. And the idea of the Oxford Group was that they considered themselves first century Christians. That is to say, Christians who lived in the first 100 years after the death of Christ, and before there was an institutional church, before there were popes and cardinals and abbots and priests and stuff. And they lived by very simple rules. They lived by what they call the absolutes. They had absolute love, absolute honesty, absolute purity. They had all kinds of things like that. They lived the golden rule. They had precepts. They had meetings, like, together. They had, they spoke. They made open confession one to each other. They made amends for all their harms done. They had a program. And they were very successful. They were very popular. So Roland found this bunch. And now we're into the 30s. And the Great Depression is on in the United States. And some of us remember the Great Depression. I remember it. And people were out of work wholesale. And not alcoholics or anything else, but everybody was in very bad shape. There was no money around. There was no jobs. There was no economy. There was nothing. And so the churches stepped in. There was no welfare in those days. There was no government programs until Roosevelt came in. But the churches did these things. Well, Roland took about 30 of the Oxford groupers from New York up to the farm in Vermont. And he let them stay at the farm, free, had the room, the board, and they had all the rest of it. And he was very happy up there, and it was beginning, it was summertime in Vermont, 1934. And the next one that came over and got in trouble was Ebby Thatcher. Ebby became an embarrassment to his family. They were very sort of straight people. They ran a big accounting CPA firm in Albany. If you go to Albany, New York now, the capital of the state of New York, you'll find Thatcher Park. It's named after his family. And they had this big Victorian home over on the main street, and Ebby came over drunk, and the first thing he did was have his car come around a corner, and he ended up in some Vermont farmer's kitchen with the automobile, and he stepped out and asked for a drink. Well, Vermonters are not notorious for their humor, just to begin with, and so they called the cops, and Ebby went in front of a judge. And the judge, I used to be a judge, the judge gave me the well-known, if I ever see you again, I'll throw the book at you speech. And Ebby confessed that his weaknesses, and he got out of that. And in a fit of alcoholic, who knows what, remorse, and he decided he would paint the house, the family house, big Victorian thing. He knew nothing about painting, but he thought he would paint the house, that would make up for the drunkenness. So he bought some paint, he got a brush, he got a ladder. And he couldn't go above the second rung. He kept falling off the ladder because he was drunk. And but he did manage to get some paint on the house. And like most of us, he paused to admire his handiwork. He brought out a beach chair and a bottle of booze, and he sat on the lawn, and a pigeon went by and shat upon the house, upon the paint. And this so enraged Brother Ebby that he went in the house and he got a shotgun. So now you have a guy with a shotgun and a bottle of booze shooting at pigeons on the lawn of a big house on the main street of Manchester, Vermont. So he's back in front of the same judge. And the judge, this is America, we have a constitution. The judge says you can make a phone call. Well, who would you call? He called Roland, his rich pals in town. Roland came down with two other people from the Oxford farm. And they rescued Ebby, took him away. The judge said, take him, get him out of here. And so now Ebby's up at the farm, not drinking. He's with Roland. Fall is coming. It's cold in Vermont. So they decided to go back to New York. In New York, in the Lower East Side, around Gramercy Park, if you know Manhattan, there's a Calvary Episcopal Church. And if you go there this very day, you'll see the main window of the church is dedicated to the Hazard family. And it was a big operation. They had the church. They had a sort of a home for homeless people. They had another building. It was a mission for drunks. And they had a soup kitchen. In the Depression, the soup kitchens were very common. You got a bowl of soup, a sandwich, and an apple. And these were people who weren't alcoholics or anything, but they didn't have enough food. And they would go to these soup kitchens and you get the food. So Roland and Ebby are working on the soup kitchen line. Roland, you know, rich, he's social service, and he's handing out the food. And Ebby testifies, and Ebby says, while he's handing out the food one day, a thought comes to him. He doesn't know where this thought came from. I better call my friend Bill Wilson. And Bill says in our book, my schoolmate called me. So I hadn't seen him for a year. I invited him over. He said he'd come over. We'll talk about the good old days, Bill says in our book. About the airplane ride. Bill and Ebby were the first people to land in an airplane in the Manchester, Vermont airport. The reason they were the first ones to land was the airport wasn't open. It was going to open the next day. And they all got drunk with the pilot, and over they went. And when they landed, the high school band was practicing for the opening the next day, and they thought the band was for them. And they come falling out of this airplane, you know. It's a small town. Everything gets around. So, and then Bill thought, this is what we'll do, the way you and I would do if one of our old drunken friends came by, right? You get out the bottle, remember this, remember that, all the stuff, all the lies you tell. Bill says in our book, the bell rang, and he opened the door, and there was Ebby. And he took him in, they sat him down in the kitchen. Bill had 3 quarts of bathtub. In those days, they made gin in the bathtub. They cleaned the bathtub, grain alcohol, some juniper berries, water, gin. He had 3 quarts of this crap. And he said, that'd be enough for a good afternoon's talk. But there was something different about Ebby. And Bill said to him, tell me, what happened to you? What's the matter with you? And Ebby said to him, I got religion. And Bill said, oh, God. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. This summer, a religious crackpot. And Ebby is full of the Oxford group. You know how you and I were when we were first sober, you remember that? We were going to call your cousin Charlie and tell him you're killing yourself, Charlie, and that shit. Yeah. And he's full of that, and he gives it to Bill. Bill doesn't want to hear it. Bill, this is crap. Bill is basically a sort of an agnostic. His real theology was, who cares? I mean, who gives a shit? I mean, really, his life is so low, you know, let me alone. And Ebby's going on and on and on about it all. And finally, he gets to the part that Bill underlines in our book. He puts it in italics, and Ebby says to him, in the Oxford group, you can form your own concept of God. See, that's theological anarchy. Imagine this place with the monks if they all had their own concept of God. We're a madhouse, you know? And that got Bill's attention. He liked that. Yeah, your own concept, you sure? He didn't stop drinking, but he enjoyed what Ebby told him. And he kept drinking, and he got drunk again and again. A couple of times he went up to visit. And finally, Bill's sobriety date is December the 11th, 1934. He checked himself in for the last time to Towns Hospital. And Ebby came to see him. And he describes it in the book. And he says, I want to read it, because when I do the book, I like to read it so I don't misstate it. I'm so full of beans that I'm liable to give you my book instead of this book. If you know what I'm talking about, then you might. Anyhow, Bill says, my schoolmate visited me. And I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my unwillingness to approach these individuals. Never was I to be critical of them, it goes on. My friend, Ebby, promised me, said Bill, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order of things were the essential requirements. Now, wouldn't you think that in a book about alcoholism, Ebby would have promised Bill that if you do this, you won't have to drink anymore? He didn't say that at all. He said, if you do what I'm suggesting you do, you can enter into a new relationship with God. I am of an opinion that Alcoholics Anonymous only has a little bit to do with drinking, if anything at all. I'm of that opinion, and I'll get to it surely very soon. Bill also admitted that he was powerless over alcohol, said he would help other alcoholics. Ebby left. Bill is now in that remorse that you and I know so well. You remember that thing? It comes at around 4 o'clock in the morning. Do you remember it? You remember that? It's about 4 in the morning, and it wakes you up for a drink. Your body says, give me booze. And this thing, the Irish call it the creature. Right, Jerry? The creature is in the room, and it wakes you up. And it's all over for you. There's no one to point at. It's not your mother, it's not your father, it's not your boss, it's not your friends. It's you. And this thing is in the room, and it's got you. And it terrorizes you. You're in terror. And every cell in your body is in terror. And you know that there's a bottle over there, and I'll take care of it. But you also know you got to get up in 3 hours and go to work, so you got to be careful what you do. Of course, you're a pig. You drink the whole thing like I did. Well, that's what Bill is in. He's in that, the terror. The creature's got him. And he throws himself out of the bed, and he's on the floor on his knees, and he says, if there is a God, if there is a God, let him show himself now. And Bill testifies that the room lit up with an intensity so great that he could no longer see the walls. And that in his mind's eye, a wind blew through that room. And in his mind's eye, he was transported to another dimension. And he said to himself, so, this is the God of the preachers, the people he used to put down. Now this has subsided, of course, and he sent for Silkworth, and Silkworth came by and looked at him and said, I don't know what happened to you, but whatever it was, you look a little better now than you did a few hours ago, and whatever it was, try to hold on to it. Pretty good advice. Bill came out of the hospital, he says, trembling. Remember that in the big book? Trembling. He left that hospital. He said, quicksand stretched in every direction. You remember that? You and I, we'd gone too far, remember? You're never going to dig out. But Roland got a hold of him, and Ebby got a hold of him. Now the three of them are on the line down the Calvary Church, handing out the soup. And Bill's tutoring around in the neighborhood, plus he's trying to interest people coming through the line in this fact that his room lit up. And people saying, oh, yeah, room, yeah, next, you know. And he's going into the bars around there, New York's full of bars. And he's trying to interest people in the fact that, you know, I'm from New York City. I was born in the Bronx. In New York, we have a certain attitude toward life, you know. And if you're trying to get a load in a bar and some big gunk comes in and wants you to know his room lit up, you know. Yeah. Your room lit up. You light this up, Charlie. Get out of here. I'll give you a light, you know. New York, it's an attitude. And he got upset, Bill, that nobody would listen to him. So he went back up to Silkworth like a baby. And he said to Silkworth, I'm trying to help these people, and nobody will pay any attention to me. And Silkworth says, you're telling them the wrong thing. Tell them what Dr. Young told Roland. They're going to die. That'll get their attention. Nobody cares about your room lit up, stupid. Except you. And we're all worried about you, you little hippie. So now Bill has this information. And now he goes to Akron, Ohio. And now it's Mother's Day of 1934. Five. And here's where it gets interesting. Here's where I make my case. I'm a lawyer. I like to present cases. That's what I used to do for a living. Here's where I make the case. It's Mother's Day weekend. They all go home, except Bill. He can't go home. He doesn't have enough money. He's got $10. Room's paid up till Monday. And he's in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel And he hears the noise from the bar on the first floor. It's a gay bar. Our book says he could hear that gay crowd inside.
Is that a gay bar?
That's what it says. And he says he's thinking about going in there to strike up an acquaintance and have a ginger ale. You know, I'm playing games in the Bronx, and this guy's got my life in his hands. He had God in his room in December. He's going to a gay bar in May. How much does it work to have God in your room? I mean, Mike. But he decides not to do that. He makes a series of phone calls. Now, here's where I make the case. He gets Henrietta Seibeling. Henrietta Seibeling is the wife of young Seibeling, whose father is chairman of the board of Goodyear. Now, you don't get any better than that in Akron, Ohio. And recently I saw Castles of America on cable, and there was a Seibeling castle. And she's in the gatehouse because she's estranged from Seibeling because he's a drunk. Henrietta is a member of the Oxford Group of Akron, Ohio. It is the practice of the Akron, Ohio Oxford Group, just like it is in some of the AA groups, if anyone has a problem, at the beginning of the month, they say, does anyone have a problem? In the month of May, 1935, Dr. Robert Smith, a local proctologist, we dress him up, we call him a surgeon. The guy was a proctologist. Not a bad specialty. You're going to deal with alcoholics for a long time. Smith confessed to them all. They had this practice of open confession in the Oxford group. He confessed to them that he was alcoholic, which they all knew anyhow. But under their practice, if you did that for the next month, every member of the group promised that they would kneel down and pray every morning for God to help whoever stood up. So every member of the Oxford group of Akron, Ohio, for the month of May, 35, had promised God and Bob that they would pray for him every day. So Henrietta was on her knees every morning asking God to send help for Bob. Now comes a disembodied voice on the phone, and he says, my name is Bill Wilson. I am a rummy from New York. I have a way to fix drunks. And Henrietta says, of course. Of course you do. See? Henrietta is a woman of faith. Henrietta believes that if she asks God to send help for Bob, God will send help for Bob. And so when this guy could be an axe murderer on the other end of that phone says, I have a sharp course. Of course. She says, of course you do. Come out here right away. He goes out to where she is. She said she wanted to look him over. Her son became, and may even still be, the congressman from Akron, Ohio. And he put all of this into the congressional record in 1971 when she died. Said she wanted to look him over, make sure he wasn't a complete lunatic. And she satisfied herself on that, and she called Bob. And it was a Saturday of Mother's Day weekend, and she got Ann Smith, Bob's wife. And she said, the man is here to fix Bob. And Ann was a member of the Ox group. She said, thank God, you know, we only have what's Mother's Day, the third weekend of May? She says, we only got another week to go, you know. She said, but Bob is under the table. He came home with a potted plant. For Mother's Day, he's more potted than the plant. And she has learned from great experience not to wake up sleeping drunks. She said, I'll bring him out in the morning. Well, you know how Bob felt the next morning. And his wife said, we got Henrietta's. There's a man there's got to fix you. And Bob says, I will give that guy from New York, that's where they talk about Wilson out in Akron, they call him that guy from New York. I will give him 15 minutes. The meeting lasted 5 hours. You remember when they put that thing on television a few years ago, Bill W., remember that, with James Woods and James Garner? And a very effective scene, and Garner is Bob, and he's very medical. And he says, just how do you think you're going to help me, Mr. Wilson? Remember that? And Woods looks at him and says, I'm not here to help you. I'm here to help me, doctor. Terrific, terrific scene. Now, in that conversation, Bob told Bill that he would do everything Bill asked him to do. Bill outlined a simple program that he had, which was no program, really. But it was the stuff that Bill did in the hospital before his room lit up. Bill went through the whole 12 steps. If you look the page before his room lights up, he's gone through the whole 12 steps. He doesn't know it, but he's doing it. Bob says, I'll do it all, except I can't make amends. I'd love to, but I'm a physician. It's a small town. I'm on my last leg anyhow. I'm hanging on by a thread at the last hospital. I've been asked to leave the others. And I can't be driving around Akron telling people that I made mistakes and that I was drunk. I can't do it. It'll ruin me. Well, Bill took what he could, and Bill moved in with Bob, into Bob's house. And he and Mrs. Bob and Bob, every morning, we used to read the Bible together. They'd read the book of James, not very much, just a couple of pages in the New Testament. And then Bob had one of those brilliant ideas we get. Remember, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Remember those? Are we married? No, it's a good idea at the time. And his good idea was to go to Atlantic City to the American Medical Association conference. His wife says, don't go there. Every time you go, you get drunk. He says, I'm going. Bill says, it's not a good idea. He says, I'm going. He was drunk before he left Akron. He got there drunk. He stayed. He came back drunk. He got into a fight in a bar. This is our beloved founder, physician. He's in a fight in a bar. And his nurse's husband happened by and grabbed him, took him home to the nurse's house, put him on a couch, called Bob's home, got Bill, and said, I got him. And Bill said, well, I'll be out in the morning, because he's got to go to the hospital tomorrow morning. He's got two operations. So Bill showed up at the house in Bob's old car. He had this old Buick, and he brought with him 2 bottles of beer and some phenobarbital. He drove him down to the city hospital. He had the 2 beers. He had the phenobarbital. And he went upstairs to work on some guy's ass. And Bill, that's what he did for a living. And Bill went back to the house. And you know, in the Midwest, we eat dinner at 5 o'clock. We have dinner. And 5 o'clock, and there's no Bob. So they know he's drunk. Correct? He's drunk. 7 o'clock, no Bob. Well, he's certainly drunk now. And it's 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, no Bob. Drunk, drunk, drunk. He walks in midnight. Dry as a bone. Didn't have a drink. First question, where were you? He said, I was driving around Akron, Ohio, mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. Making amends. See? What Bob did with Bill, he said to Bill, I'll take 85%, 90% of your program, but I can't take the whole program. At some of these steps, we walked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. But the results were nil until we let go, and let go absolutely. Here's an opinion. There is no such thing as conditional sobriety. I will become sober if I get a job. I will become sober if she comes back, or if he comes back. I will not make the amends. I'll do everything else. It won't work. It won't work. You have to have the whole thing, or it's just not going to work. It's too bad, but that's the way it is. And so it was for Bob. And once he did those amends, he never drank again. That was that. Now, then you all know the rest of the story, because now it's Akron, Ohio, it's 1935, they get the third guy, and da-da-da-da-da, and on to glory. And here we are, in 1997, in Colton, Alabama. That's a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And I'm not talking about geography. And you know that. And I submit to you that the hand of God is all through this thing. That it is not coincidence that these young people, before the first war, assembled the way they did. They had no idea what they were doing. Do you think in 1916 he said to him, you're going to be the founder of AA in life, you know? I'm trying to get through high school. Leave me alone, you know? But there it is, and it's not coincidence. It's the hand of God moves. It moves all through this thing. It's like an enormous morality play. And these people have their roles assigned to them, and they didn't know what they were doing. All they knew was they were in desperate trouble. Bob was in debt, you know. It was the end of it for all of us. Bill writes about all of this, and Bob says of this meeting with Bill, of far more importance was the fact that Bill was the first living human with whom I had ever talked, who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. And that seems to be the key of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. We read the preamble, we share our experience, our strength, and our hope. It is the experience that brings the strength. And it's the strength that generates the hope. And that's what we share. And that's why I say to you, when I start these things, what I bring to the party is experience. I've seen lots and lots of stuff in there, and I'm able to remember most of what I saw. Bill goes on to say, you know, there are a lot of myths around AA about lots of stuff, and some of the stuff we have here, you know, it sounds good. People start to believe it pretty soon as gospel, and it isn't. It's not true. And who am I to say, but, well, I know who I am to say. I know what I'm doing here. So anyhow, Bill says, during the next 3 years after Bob's recovery, so it's 35 to 38, our growing groups at Akron, New York, and Cleveland evolved a so-called word-of-mouth program. It's before there were the steps. As we commenced to form a society separate from the Oxford group, you know, they stayed in Akron with the Oxford group to 1938. But when Bill came back from Akron, Ohio to New York where he lived in 1935, he started a group in his father-in-law's home on Clinton Street in Brooklyn, and apart from the Oxford group. But in Cleveland and Akron, they didn't separate till 38. Clarence Schneider used to tell a great story about it. He had a couple of Catholics who told him they couldn't go to the Oxford group because their priest told them it was Episcopal and they couldn't go and all that stuff. So he brought it to our very spiritual co-founder, who said, well, we're going to have some drunken Catholics on our hands. Let's get on with it. So he stayed with the Oxford group. So anyhow, here's what they said orally. These were their principles. And these principles were similar to the so-called precepts of the Oxford group. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. 1, 2, we got honest with ourselves. 3, we got honest with another person in confidence. 4, we made amends for harms done others. 5, we worked with other alcoholics without demand for prestige or money. 6, we prayed to God to help us do these things as best we could. Bill goes on to say, I remember well the evening upon which the 12 steps were written. I was lying in bed, quite dejected and suffering from one of my imaginary ulcer attacks. This is our beloved founder. He's loony. He thinks he has ulcers. He don't have ulcers. 4 chapters of the book have been read in Akron and New York. We found out that everybody wanted to be an author. Ever been to an AA business meeting? The hassles that were what you go into the book were terrific. Some wanted a purely psychological book. We could tell them about God later. A few led by Fitz were a fairly religious book. The louder the arguments, the more in the middle it appeared. I wasn't going to be an author at all. I was going to be an umpire who would decide the contents of the book. Well, as you all know, in 1939, the book came out. And the book, for the first time, had the 12 steps in the form that we now have them. Now, in 1960, on the occasion of our 25th anniversary, Bill Wilson wrote a letter to Carl Jung. And he said to Carl Jung in his letter, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous consider you to be a founder, because years ago you had a patient named Roland Hazard, and you gave him a message, and he brought it to Ebbie Thatcher, who brought it to me, and I brought it to Bob. And now we are 25 years old. We are in the United States. We're very successful. We have some meetings in Europe, and I want to thank you." And he got back a very nice letter from Carl Jung. And Carl Jung, who was in the last year of his life, said to Bill, "I remember Roland Hazard. His problem was that he had separated himself from the whole, W-H-O-L-E. In medieval language, he had separated himself from a union with God," unquote. So it is the opinion of Jung that alcoholism is caused by a separation from God. And then Jung went on to make a pun in Latin. He said, "Spiritus contra spiritum." In Latin, to show you I'm an erudite and a graduate of Catholic schools, the same word in Latin expresses spirit and alcohol. Spirits. And Jung says, "Spiritus, spirits, contra, against spirit." And he said of Roland Hazard, he had separated himself from God. And this is how I come to the next opinion about the cause of a spiritual disease. It's spiritus contra spiritum. I don't know when I separated myself from God. I don't know that. I don't know that I was ever joined. I never seemed to be religious at all, though I have a religious background and a religious education. I'm very, very delighted to have both of those things, and I'm very grateful. It just never interested me. But somewhere along the line, I separated myself from God. And our book says that at the core of my alcoholism, there is self. Self is a self-centeredness, selfishness. That's the cause of my alcoholism, self. And when I separated myself from God, our book is very clear on this. It says God has all power. And when you separate yourself, when I separated myself from all power, I'm powerless. No? The logic is impeccable. I am without power. I had separated myself from all power. And in my opinion, the first step is simply a statement of what was the matter with me on November 24th, 1965. I had come to a point, I think we all do, I think it's different in every case, but I had come to a point where, as our book says, I could no longer imagine a life with alcohol or without alcohol. And I had gone beyond the point. There's some line someplace. I believe there's a line someplace beyond which we are not permitted to go. And there's a point somewhere below which we can't reach. And there's a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where that line is for you. How would I know? I know what happened to me. It was just too much for me. It was too much. Too much. Without help, it's too much for me. It's 32 years later. Without help, it's too much for me. I can't do it by myself. Oh, I could do lots of other things, and I did by myself. But I couldn't do this by myself, and therefore I come to the first word of the first step, we. That's where it was for me. I never had that idea much in my life. We. Who's me, Laura? I had no father. I had an alcoholic mother. I grew up in the South Bronx in the Depression, and I didn't have time for niceties. I just had time for me. And I separated myself from God somewhere. And in doing so, I separated myself from y'all, from all of you. I had no interest in you, whatever. People, to me, were disposable, just like a Kleenex. Use them, blow your nose, and the next one pops right up out of the box. It's pretty interesting. I never had that connection until I got here, because I really never needed it. I was pretty self-sufficient, and I was born bright. I acted bright. I was born tough. I acted tough. But when I came face to face with the creature, nobody is that smart. Nobody's that tough. That thing hit me, and it just destroyed me. So tomorrow I'll talk about the first step. Thank you. This is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. Can we open this meeting with a moment of silent meditation followed by the serenity prayer, please? Thank you, God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Most places I go to are AA places, and they have the steps usually on the wall behind me, so if I keep doing this, you'll understand I'm referring to the wording of the steps. And last night I was quoting Dr. Jung. I have the exact words here. Talking of Roland Hazard, Jung said on January 30th, 1961, in a letter to Bill Wilson, Roland's craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, wholeness, expressed in medieval language a union with God. And in our book, it tells us that when it comes to the first step, the words of which are, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, zip. There's no connecting word in there, that our lives had become unmanageable. And in the book, in the third chapter, in the first page, it says we learned, we don't know these things, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholics, and that was my experience. I had to come here twice. I came the first time in 1963. I stayed 10 months, and I got drunk after 10 months. I did not have a sponsor. I did not have a home group. I didn't need a sponsor or a home group. I'm an attorney. So I got drunk instead, and came back in 1965, and I had to learn. I didn't know these things. I knew I drank like a pig, but practically everybody I knew drank the way I drank. And my whole family drank the way I drank. That's why they died. And I don't know what I thought. I suppose I thought, well, now it's my turn. But one day, and it was no different than so many other days. That day, November 24, 65, it was just another day. And I felt as though I was going to jump out of a window. And I had not had a drink in a couple of days, and I was feeling that way, and I really wanted to have a drink, and I had money. I had fresh money. Nothing like fresh money with a drunk boy. And I had a choice to make. The choice, there was a bar in the lobby of the building where I was. And my sponsor was about three blocks away. He wasn't my sponsor then. He was just a guy I knew, a lawyer who had come to AA, got successfully sober. And that's, I think it's providential. I think it was, I was directed to call him rather than go down to the bar. And he came in, and he looked so good, and I felt terrible. And I asked him what to do, and he started to tell me what to do. And I followed his instructions. He was just the right sponsor for me. He was that way, you know. I'd tell him, I'd say to him, you know, you whine. I'd say, I don't feel well. He said, well, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. I said, when will I get a good job? He said, when you're ready. I said, well, how will I know I'm ready? He said, you'll have a good job. I thought... I thought I told you that. Yeah? And then he'd give you that reptilian stare like you were some species of turd, you know. He just... And you're supposed to know these things, you know. He was like a Zen master. He was very air and smoke and mirrors and things. And he'd get very funereal, you know. And I'd say, I'm a nervous wreck. What should I do? You know, you're pitching everything as emergency. Say, hang on. So, how do you hang on? You say, let go. Well, he was just the right sponsor for me because he was... I just finished. He lives now in Ireland. He's retired. And I just finished a week's visit with him. He stayed at my house. And it was really great. But I had to learn this. And I had to learn to concede to my innermost self. You know, some people say the first step is physical. The second step, that's not true. It's one of my opinions. All of the steps are spiritual. From the first word of the first step to the last word of the last step. From the newest member to the oldest member. It's all spiritual. There is no physical. We don't have any physical. We don't have any leafy green diets. We don't have broccoli. Thank God we don't have broccoli. We don't have any aerobics. We don't have running shoes. We don't have any of that crap, you know. We sit around, we drink coffee, we smoke cigarettes, and we get better. That's all. And when I have to concede to my innermost self, you see, what you see before you, this is my outermost self. This magnificent structure I present to you. This temple of my soul. I'll give you the full view here. This is my outermost self, see? But this is not me, as you know. This... I'm lucky if this is going to last all day, you know. This is on the very edge, this thing. This has been around for 70 years, and I don't think it's going to last much longer. And we all know that. And this is not where I live. This is where I live, in my innermost self. And the word I use to describe the innermost self is the spirit. Some people call it the soul. Some people call it the innermost self. But that's where you and I live. And that's where the disease of alcoholism goes. The physical part of alcoholism is not much. You know, you detoxify in 5 days. And you really clear out in about 90 days. And all of your brain takes a little longer for the traces and all that stuff to leave. But the physical part of alcoholism is not much at all. But that our book tells us of the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. When we are demoralized, when our spirit is reduced. I thought mine was gone. I really did. And there wasn't a goddamn thing in the world I could do about it. And I sat there and I thought, God, this is... And I'm going right down the tubes and no one cares about it. No one gives one care at all. And I'm sinking. And they think I'm stupid. And they think I'm weak. And they think I'm all of these things. And there's nothing I can do. God, I went to AA. Didn't work. I'm totally, irrevocably screwed. I went to the last house on the block and I couldn't get sober. And now this dope shows up in my office and I try to tell him what a pain in the ass my wife was. And he said if I didn't drink and I went to the meetings, maybe that would get a little better. I told him I was surrounded by assassins and assholes. Being held back while men of inferior quality got ahead. He said if I didn't drink, if I went to the meetings, maybe, you know, I could be a little more successful. I thought I was in sort of like a 25-year streak of bad luck, you know, misadventures and circumstances. I told him that I was being sued by a bank. He said he knew that. Oh. There's a misunderstanding about a loan application. It's really nothing. It's really nothing. Did not deserve to be in the New York Times, I'll tell you. He told me I could settle that case if I didn't drink and go to the meeting. I sort of sensed there was no dialogue there. Because I was talking about one thing and he was talking about something else, you know? And he told me that that he had the same feelings that I had, and that he had gotten a home group and a sponsor and gone to a lot of meetings, and he was very happy with the way he was living at the time. And I knew him. I knew him to be a successful lawyer, as a partner in a very good firm and all the rest of it. So I started that way to find out about it. And this is the stuff I had to learn. I had to learn to concede to my innermost self, to in my spirit, to say it to myself. See, what difference does it make what I say to you? What do you care? I say I'm an alcoholic. He's nice. He's an alcoholic. Are you a Democrat? Yeah, I'm a Democrat. He's also a Democrat. What do you care? It has nothing to do with you. It's what I tell me that counts. See? I have to live with this thing. Now, when this goes away, I don't know what's going to happen. I have a suspicion based on all kinds of stuff that this may survive. If that be true, then I don't have to worry so much about this. I got to worry a lot about this. And when I present this wherever it's going, I guess that's question number one. Did you concede your innermost self? And the concession is that I am powerless over alcohol. It isn't a question of drinking more or drinking less. I know I'm preaching to the choir. There's no need for me to tell you all of this. But I guess I have to, I tell it to myself more than anybody else. That no matter what else happens, I'm not allowed to be anywhere near that stuff. Because I have no power about it. The book goes on to say of me, I find the book is almost a biography. It says that I'm in a dilemma. You know the dilemma, the philosophers say the horns of the dilemma. Either way you've had it. Either way you go, you're ruined. And it says the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. That is our dilemma, lack of power. We must, it says, must find a power greater than our own by which we can live our lives. Now, wouldn't you think in a book about alcoholism, it would say, I'm in a dilemma. Here's my dilemma. I drink when I don't want to drink. Like you said. I get drunk when I don't want to get drunk. I screw everything up when I don't want to. Wouldn't you think that would, what did they say? They don't say that at all. They talk in terms of a spiritual concept. Being without power. Imagine. Now, Bill Wilson said of himself, and he might as well have said it of me, he said he was power-driven, Bill. And so was I. The three things that got my attention were money, power, and sex. Oh, I liked other things. I mean, I still do. I like classical music and stuff like that. But the thing that got me moving around was money or power or sex. If you said to me, come on over and I have a new CD of Mozart, I might say, all right, Jerry, I'll come over, but not at this moment. A little later, perhaps, someday during the week, I'll call you. Well, if you call me up and say, come on over here and bang my rich cousin, boom. Well, like I was shot out of a gun. Hi, do you do, Jerry, pal? How's the family? That got me up and moving. Money, power, sex. And when you are powerless, I wasn't moving very much out there. I had this chair I used to sit in. And I smoked cigarettes in those days. Poor malls, I used to sort of drop them in the chair and the chair would go on fire. But it really didn't flame out much because I used to take a leak in the chair all the time. So it was sort of just sort of wet and soggy, you know. And these terrible smelly fumes would come up, and no flame or anything. And I would sit there in my Brooks Brothers underwear. Brooks Brothers underwear. And watch the Dick Van Dyke Show or something, you know. And I had been a university professor. In 1957, I was the youngest tenured professor of law in the United States. Now I'm sitting in a chair in my underwear setting fire to chairs, you know? Planning my comeback, my revenge, you know, sons of bitches. You know, you're going to hear from me, boy. I'm going to get some dry clothes and I'm going to kick some serious ass around here, brother. You know, who do you think you're fooling with, the kid? Drinking warm vodka. You know, you don't get very productive that way. And the question of I couldn't manage. I just couldn't manage. And it was just too much. It was too much for me. It was such a goddamn hassle. I have a friend of mine who's a physician in Louisville, Kentucky, member of AA. Really a remarkable guy, very bright, and he's been looking at this problem for years. And I like what he says. Here's what he says about us. He says, alcoholics are born not feeling good. They're not sick. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't need any medicine. They just don't feel good. It's a hassle. They're in the wrong family. Their brother gets the good stuff. They get crap for Christmas. School is a pain in the ass. They have a hard time making friends. Their mother's unbearable. Father's worse. And one day, when they're about 12, maybe 13, somebody puts a drink in their hand and says, I'm one of these. And they do. And they drink it down and they go, ooh. Well, I have another one of those. And they have another one, and they think the whole thing over, and they say, well, my mother's all right. Can I have another one of those? And that house is okay. It's not the best school in the world, but it's okay. I can handle it. What the hell was I worried about? I'll have another one. And they begin to feel good. It's an expression we use. He's feeling good. For the first time in their life, they feel good. It's okay, all their zits fall on the floor. Girls' boobs pop out of their shirt, you know? They're okay. They're all right. They can look around, you know, and they stop stuttering. And Jesus, that was a marvelous thing that happened with that. And they have no ill effects from it. And so they pursue it. Unfortunately, we're dealing with a narcotic substance, so you got to have more to get less. And there comes the inevitable day when you're destroyed. Not, I could have had more to drink physically. You know, I could have had more. My brother, if you ever took us, saw us, you wouldn't take us to be brothers. My brother Billy, I talk about him all the time. He was about 6'3", career Marine, gunnery sergeant. He was a poster Marine. He looked like a Marine. He acted like a Marine. He was a Marine. Through the war, through Okinawa, through everything, through Korea. He died when he was 48. Died in the Veterans Hospital, collapsed on the street, lived on Skid Row, had his pension check sent to my sister. And he weighed 100 pounds when he died. 6'4". And he had me named as his next of kin. And they sent me the stuff that he had and crap. But he was 48. I came as 37, second time. And I thought about my brother. I thought I can last another 5 years. Maybe he was much stronger than I was. Well, I could maybe get 5 years out of this. And I wasn't, my liver was not physically, I wasn't suffering that way. But I was in the grip of this terror. This thing had me. And I swear to God, I didn't think I'd last another day without flying into a million pieces. And that's where alcoholism lives. It doesn't live in the liver or the esophagus or the kidneys or the heart, although it affects all of those things. Alcoholism is in the spirit. And it is not caused by alcohol. Alcohol does not cause alcoholism. Alcoholism is something else. Alcoholism is a condition that just waits for you to put the alcohol into it. Menninger, the seminal psychiatrist in the United States, Menninger's work on psychiatry, several volumes, he has alcoholism in the chapter on suicide. And he says of alcoholics, of you and me, that the alcohol is the glue that keeps them together. Without the alcohol, he said, they jump off buildings. They couldn't stand it without the alcohol. And Silkworth says of me, He says people like O'Keefe drink for the effect of it. The illusionary feeling, it's an illusion and a delusion that comes, he says, people like me, and he's writing of me when I don't drink, are nervous, irritable, and discontented without the alcohol. And he says the alcohol reacts immediately, and it removes irritability, nervousness, and discontent. And I'm all right. I'm feeling good. And that's what Menninger says. Menninger says without the alcohol, they go right out the window. They couldn't possibly bear it. Life is too much for these people. Life is too much for us, the poet said, lately coming and going. It's just too much. And our book puts it in terms of experience. It says without help, it's too much. And where will we get the help? Well, for years and years, there was no help. There was no help. We were talking last night, someone and I were talking about maybe June 10th is not our birthday because the AMA convention, there's somebody's doing research, maybe it's June 17th instead of June 10th. But it really makes no difference. But here's the reason we picked June 10th was we thought June 10th was Bob's last day. You see, over the course of history, there have always been people who didn't drink. Not drinking is not new. There are many, many people in this world who never drank. There are many people scattered throughout the universe who never had a drink of alcohol ever, and never will. They'll go to their grave without alcohol. And there are many people, I know people who never should drink. Drink is too good for a lot of people. I have a brother-in-law, Louis, graduate of the Harvard Law School, Louis is. And you say, Louis, would you like another drink, Louis? You know what Louis says? No, thank you. I am beginning to feel it. You like to get him by the throat. And you say, that's what it's for, Louis. It's for you to feel it, you dumb bastard. Not for you to stun an ice cream soda where it tastes good. This is crap goes in your head. And he just stared. He shouldn't even have it. Nobody should give Louis a drink. He's the kind of guy who's drinking a bad name. There are people who drink and puke and they stop drinking. With us, it's an art form, after all. Because we need that. We need that. Makes us feel good. And, you know, nobody else understands that. When I say to you it's 4 o'clock in the morning the way I did last night, did you know what I was talking about? You bet your life you did. If I said that to Louis, he said, that's an odd hour to wake up. I get up at 6 myself. See, all of this, what's going on with us is on another level. It's not on this level at all. It's not on the level of livers and hands and hearts. It's on the level of spirit. Spirit. And that's why Jung was so bright when he said spiritus contra spiritum, because Jung knew exactly where the problem was. The problem was not that we drank. Did you have anyone ever have to study how to drink? They don't have to tell you how to go about that. You knew how to do that just like a salmon knows how to go upstream. You didn't have to ask anybody where to stand, how to do it, where to put it. You were the one belt of it and you were ready to roll. And it was a whole new process. And so the first step is much more than not drinking. You see, if the problem were alcohol, the answer would be not to drink. Correct? If your problem was you drank alcohol, stop drinking. You could say to a 12-year-old kid, look at him, he drinks a lot. What do you think he should do? The kid would say, tell him not to drink. We'd have a one-step program. You'd come in and be a sign on the wall which says, don't drink. And the guy would say, how you feeling? He'd say, I feel all right. Well, good, don't drink. Anything else you want to know? No, we'll come back next week. Why the hell would you come back next week? If it's not drinking, just don't drink. And go about your business. See, if people come here, well, a lot of people come here, I don't know who's in this room, but a lot of people come here now who are not alcoholics. And their problem is the substance they use, cocaine, heroin, that kind of stuff. Those people just have to stop using and stop hanging out in that lifestyle. And their problem will solve themselves. They don't have to do all the stuff. They don't need what we have. It's a different disease. I'll get to that in the 12th step. But with us, the disease is not in the substance. The disease is in us. It's in the spirit. It's in our innermost selves. Now, whether it got there by birth, whether it got there through nurture, through nature, who do, I don't, you know, I'm not interested in getting into it because I really don't know the answer, and I don't know anybody that does. But it's in there. And so the answer has to be a spiritus one, a spiritual one. And that's why we can see to our innermost self. The question was not that we drank, the question was that I didn't know how to live. I had no way to manage a life. I had no guidance to that. And I'm an educated person. I have a religious education. I have all of that stuff. I've had the path pointed out to me. I was 19 years in the Catholic school system. I'm a graduate of a Jesuit university. That's as much as you can get, you know, without taking a tonsure or something. But I didn't know how to manage my life. The outside rules never transferred to my inside. And I knew the outside rules. I'm an honor student. I graduated with honors from every school ever. I know the rules. But they were rules. They were not part of me. They never translated into where I really live. And I suppose that's because my self was so selfish, so self-centered, that I really didn't think I needed that. But this is different. Here, I need this. And our book says, yes, I must have this thing. It isn't that it's going to do me good and it isn't it's going to make me better. I must have this thing. Because if I don't have this thing, I'm going to turn into a puddle of pee on the floor. That's just how I felt on November 24. I'm going to disappear. I'm going to die. And they'll never know. They'll think I was stupid and drunk and ignorant. And my ego just couldn't stand dying that way. People think, oh, he's a drunken bum and he's dead. That's what they thought of my brother. Not going to happen to me. And there was nothing I could do about it. Nothing. But I came here and I got into a sponsor. I got a home group. It's not a difficult thing, you know. We don't have any mountains to climb here. You understand? We have a path. It says, rarely have we ever seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And what's a path? You look over there, you see that path, you know that that has been made by the steps of people who have gone there before us. And you know when you see that path, it goes somewhere. Otherwise, there's no point to the path. The path is there because people have used it to go someplace. And if you don't know where the path goes, the best thing to have, we have Jerry. Jerry showed me last night which path to take to get over here today. He said, there's the door and there's the path. And this morning, I just came right over. But in our context, of course, that's the sponsor. He knows the path and, more importantly, he knows where it comes out. And it doesn't come out, see, if it were just a not drinking operation. If that were the problem, drink or not drink, at the end it would say, and he is a totally dry person. We don't say that at all. We say his spirit has awakened. And that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the awakening of the spirit. Oh, it isn't so much that I was evil, I tried to be. But I sort of just pathetic, you know. I went to 5,000 bars and I got laid twice. Just pathetic, you know. I thought I was something of a roué, you know, man of the world. You know? Just pathetic, pathetic. And that all changes. But it starts with this. It starts with this. And that realization of that pitiful and incomprehensible demise, you know, how the hell did this happen to me? Jesus, 4 years ago they were honoring me and ceremony this and that. They made me a tenured professor, a lifetime job. And now I have no job at all. And I'm sitting around here and I'm worthless and hopeless. What a blow this was. What an ego I had. It was fed constantly. And this was the first thing in my life I'd ever failed at. Everything else, I'd never failed at anything. Except this. And boy, did I fail with a big bang. And I was left with isolation and terror. And the alcohol caused me the isolation. I couldn't be with people. All that hate would pour out of me. And my mouth would go, oh, brother. And nobody wanted to be around me. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to be around me. In fact, I did not want to be around me. And you end up isolated. And the more isolated I became, the more terrorized I became. And the more isolated I was, the more desperate I was. And the more desperate I was, the more despairing I was. Until I realized, and I knew, and I'm bright, there was no way out. I was screwed. Irrevocably, terminally screwed. Nobody could get me out of it. I had gone too far. And I was prepared to die like the rest of them. I'm the only male in my family to make age 50. And we're a big bunch, big Irish bunch. All the men are dead. I'm a patriarch of a bunch of women. All my female cousins are all alive and all that stuff. But I'm the only man that's alive. I'm the only cousin, the only uncle. I'm it. And I'm also the only one in AA, so that tells you something. And that's how I came to the first step. And a lot of people think the first step says, tell me how you drank. Well, you don't want to hear how I drank. I drank the way you drank. And it's not important how I drank. The problem was never in my drinking. The problem was in my thinking. The book says the problem centers in the mind. Now, the mind is not the brain. The brain is an organ that sits up here like a little hat, gelatin-like. It goes in the back here. It's right under that skull. And when they do operations, they cut a little hole in the skull. They take it out, and they look down, and they take a suction cup, suction line, and they go to piano lessons, you know. Now, that's the brain. See, that's an organ, just like hands, nose, eyes. That's, and they look and they see there is an electrical, it's a computer, it's working all the time. The problem doesn't center in the brain. The problem centers in the mind. So the next question is, where is the mind? And the answer is, nobody seems to know. You can't x-ray the mind. You can't put the suction in on the mind. The mind is the medical, technical equivalent of the soul, correct? And the soul is the spirit. The problem centers in the spirit, not in anything else. Now, wouldn't you think, I would think, see, if they asked me to write this book, I'm capable of things like that. I would have said the problem is we drink too much. The problem is we drink like pigs. Lay off that booze, Charlie. Not at all. You know, there's not even a chapter in this whole book about how to drink, how not to drink, you know, lie in your stomach, sit on the edge of your own bed, don't drink on Sunday night. Nothing about it. Lots in there about God. Lots in there about praying, meditating. What the hell has that got to do with drinking? It has nothing to do with drinking. This first step is the only one that comes anywhere near this idea of we drink too much. The problem is in the spirit. And therefore we have to get to the spirit.